They came because the law said they belonged. On June 22, 1948, the SS Empire Windrush docked at Tilbury in Essex. It carried over 800 passengers from the Caribbean. Many were veterans who had recently worn the British uniform to fight a global war against tyranny. They were greeted by the grey mist of the Thames and the cameras of a curious press. To the men and women on the deck, they were not moving to a foreign land. They were coming to the centre of an empire they had been taught to love since childhood. They were the answer to a desperate call for Labour to rebuild a broken Britain. But as the first foot hit the stone of the pier, the myth of the mother country began to fracture. This was the start of a journey defined by a promise made in public and a betrayal plotted in the quiet halls of power. Our history is not just about the arrival. It is about the struggle to be seen in a country that wanted our hands but not our faces. Chapter 1. The Call of the Mother. Country. The war had stripped Britain of its muscle and its pride. In 1948, the cities were still piles of jagged brick and charred timber. The workforce was hollowed out. Thousands of young British men were buried in the soil of Europe and North Africa. The Colonial Office knew the Empire was the only reservoir left. They needed people to drive the buses. They needed women to scrub the floors of the new National Health Service. They needed the very people they had spent centuries colonizing to save the heart of the kingdom. That same year, the British Nationality Act was passed. It was a clear piece of legislation. It granted the status of British citizen to every person living in the UK and its colonies. It was an open door. It was a legal invitation to come home to the mother country. In Jamaica and Trinidad, the invitation felt like a lifeline. The islands were struggling with their own economic stagnation. Young men in Kingston saw the advertisements in the newspapers. The fare was £28.10. For many, this was a fortune. They sold their small plots of land. They pawned their jewelry. They pooled the resources of entire families to buy a single ticket for one son or one daughter. The belief was absolute. We were British. We spoke the language. We sang the national anthem in our schools. We were told that the streets of London were the source of all civilization. There was a sense of duty mixed with the hope of a paycheck. The voyage of the Empire Windrush took 3 weeks. On the ship, there was an air of celebration. There were musicians like Lord Kitchener, who composed calypso songs about London being the place for him. There were ex-servicemen who polished their boots and pressed their trousers. They wanted to look their best for the country they had served. They expected a handshake. They expected to be recognized as brothers in arms. They did not know that while they were crossing the Atlantic, the British government was already panicking. Prime Minister Clement Attlee received a letter from 11 members of Parliament. They called the arrival of these British citizens an influx that would cause trouble. The government even considered diverting the ship to East Africa or the Caribbean islands to prevent them from landing. The law said they were citizens, but the politicians saw them as an infection. When the ship finally docked at 7 a.m. at Tilbury, the reality was cold. The air was damp. The sky was a shade of white that felt like a wall. The press asked the passengers why they were there. They answered with confidence. They said they were here to work. They were here to help. Because they had no housing arranged. The first few hundred were taken to a deep air raid shelter in Clapham Common. It was a hole in the ground, a labyrinth of bunks buried under the city. It was a metaphor for how Britain intended to treat its new arrivals. They were to be kept out of sight. They were a utility, not a community. The labor exchange came to the shelter to process them. The jobs offered were the ones the local population refused to do. They were sent to the foundries. They were sent to the night shifts in the hospitals. They were sent to the railway yards, where the soot turned their skin gray by morning. They worked with an intensity that surprised their supervisors. They believed that hard work would earn them the respect they were promised. But the social fabric of London, in the late 1940s, was not ready for the colour of their skin. In the tea rooms and the pubs, the silence would fall the moment a Caribbean man walked through the door. The citizenship papers in their pockets meant nothing to the man behind the bar. The psychological toll began to settle in during those first few months. The mother country was not a mother at all. It was a landlord who didn't want you in the house. The migrants wrote letters back home. They were careful with their words. They didn't want to shame their families or admit they were sleeping in basements. They sent back money, but they kept the truth of the loneliness to themselves. They were living in a paradox. They were legally British but socially alien. They were essential to the economy, but unwanted in the neighborhood. The foundation of the diaspora was being laid in the damp soil of a country that was already looking for a way to push them back. As the sun set on the first year of the Windrush era, the initial excitement was replaced by a hard, shivering resolve. The invitation was real, but the welcome was a lie. The ships kept coming. The Reina del Mar, the SS Orbiter, the SS Georgic, each one brought more people who believed the promise. Each one brought more hands to build the hospitals and the transport systems. By 1950, the Caribbean presence in London, Birmingham, and Manchester was no longer a curiosity. It was a permanent fixture. And as the numbers grew, so did the friction. The British public began to realize that we were not just visiting, we were staying. The pressure in the streets began to rise like steam in a capped pipe. The first cracks were appearing in the pavement of the imperial dream, and the wind was starting to bite. Chapter 2. The Concrete Cold. By the mid-1950s, the dream of a warm welcome had frozen solid. The most immediate battleground was the front door. To live in Britain, you needed a roof, but the roofs of London were guarded by a silent and pervasive gatekeeping. It was common to see signs in the windows of boarding houses. They were handwritten and blunt. They read, "No blacks, no Irish, no dogs." This was the color bar in its most physical form. Our people were forced into the most dilapidated parts of the city. We moved into the crumbling terraces of Brixton, Notting Hill, and Handsworth. These were areas scarred by bomb sites and neglected by the councils. We were charged double the rent for a single room with a paraffin heater and a shared toilet that rarely worked. This housing crisis forced a new kind of survival. Since the banks would not give us loans and the landlords would not give us leases, we turned to our own traditions. We used the Pardner or Susu system. It was a rotating credit union built on trust. Everyone put in a portion of their weekly wages, and one person took the lump sum to buy a house. This was how we bought our first footholds in the brick and mortar of Britain. We didn't wait for permission. We carved out spaces for ourselves. But as we began to own property and settle in, the resentment from the local white working class turned from cold stares into open violence. The tension broke in the summer of 1958. In Notting Hill, gangs of white youths, known as Teddy Boys, began nigger hunting. They carried iron bars, butcher knives, and leather belts. They roamed the streets, looking for anyone with dark skin. They threw petrol bombs into the windows of Caribbean homes. For 5 nights, the streets of West London were a war zone. The police were often slow to act, and when they did, they frequently arrested the victims who were defending their families. It was a rupture that ended the illusion of safety. We realized that the state would not protect us. We had to protect ourselves. In the middle of this fire, leaders emerged. Claudia Jones, a brilliant activist from Trinidad, who had been deported from the United States for her communist ties, saw the need for a voice. In 1958, she founded the West Indian Gazette. It was the first major black newspaper in Britain. It wasn't just about news. It was a tool for political organization. She understood that if we did not tell our own story, the British press would paint us as the cause of the riots rather than the targets of them. Jones and others began to push back against the color bar in the labor unions. Even in the workplace, where we were the backbone of the industry, the unions often conspired with management to keep black workers out of supervisory roles. The violence of 58 wasn't isolated to London. In Nottingham, similar riots broke out. The St. Answell area saw hundreds of white people clashing with the Caribbean community. The authorities tried to dismiss it as hooliganism, but the community knew better. It was a coordinated rejection of our existence. The trauma of those nights changed the psyche of the diaspora. The polite, quiet migrant of 1948 was gone. In his place was a generation that realized they were in a fight for their lives. We began to build blues parties and shebeens in our basements because we were barred from the local pubs. We created our own social world behind closed doors. Despite the riots and the housing bans, the community continued to grow. Mothers brought over their children, who had been left with grandmothers in the islands. These children, the left-behind generation, arrived to find a mother country that was grey and a mother who was a stranger. They entered a school system that labeled them educationally subnormal because of their accents. The pressure was coming from every direction: the streets, the landlords, the employers, and the schools. The state was beginning to look for ways to shut the door for good. The government saw the resistance of the Caribbean community as a problem to be solved with legislation rather than justice. They didn't see the petrol bombs as the issue. They saw our presence as the issue. In the dark corners of Parliament, the talk shifted from recruitment to restriction. They had used our labor to fix the trains and the hospitals, and now they wanted to find a way to revoke the citizenship they had so freely given in 48. The atmosphere was thickening with a new kind of threat. It wasn't just the iron bars of the Teddy Boys anymore. It was the pen of the legislator. The cold was no longer just in the weather. It was in the law. Chapter 3. The Roots in the Rubble. As the 1960s dawned, the Caribbean community in Britain stopped trying to fit in and started to stand out. If the country wouldn't give us a place, we would make one that they couldn't ignore. In 1959, Claudia Jones organized an indoor Caribbean carnival at St. Pancras Town Hall. She said, "A people's art is the genesis of their freedom." This was the seed that would eventually grow into the Notting Hill Carnival. It was a defiant act of joy in a neighborhood that had recently been stained with the blood of riots. We brought the steel pan and the calypso into the gray streets. We turned the bomb sites into stages. It was a signal to the British establishment: we are here, we are vibrant, and we are not leaving. But the state was moving to silence the music. In 1962, the government passed the Commonwealth Immigrants Act. This was the first major betrayal. It stripped away the automatic right of Commonwealth citizens to live and work in the UK. Now, you needed a job voucher. The door that was kicked open in 1948 was being slammed shut. This created a frantic rush. Thousands of families in the Caribbean hurried to join their relatives in Britain before the deadline passed. It split families and created a permanent sense of precariousness. We were no longer British subjects. We were immigrants. The political climate turned toxic. In 1964, in the election for Smethwick, a candidate ran on the slogan, "If you want a nigger for a neighbor, vote Labour." He won. The hatred was no longer confined to street gangs. It was a winning political strategy. This peaked in 1968 with Enoch Powell's Rivers of Blood speech. He stood before a microphone and predicted a race war. He spoke of the black man having the whip hand over the white man. He used the fears of elderly white residents to paint a picture of an England being destroyed by the very people who were cleaning its hospital floors. Powell was sacked from the shadow cabinet, but the damage was done. Thousands of dock workers and meat porters marched in support of him. The message to the Caribbean community was deafening. No matter how long you have been here, no matter how hard you work, you will always be an outsider. This era saw the rise of the sus laws, where police could stop and search anyone based on suspicion. It was used almost exclusively to harass young black men. The friction between the community and the police became a permanent feature of British life. Yet in this pressure cooker, a new British Caribbean identity was forged. The children who had arrived in the 50s were now teenagers. They didn't have the same mother country illusions as their parents. They were born or raised in the UK. They spoke with London or Birmingham accents. They listened to ska and reggae. They formed the Black Parents Movement and the Black Students Movement. They began to fight back against the educationally subnormal labels in schools. They were building a political consciousness that was rooted in the UK, but connected to the global Black Power movement. By the early 1970s, the legal trap was fully set. The Immigration Act of 1971 further restricted rights, effectively ending large-scale migration from the Caribbean. It created a complex web of patrial and non-patrial status that would, decades later, lead to the Windrush scandal of the 2010s. The government was building a system that relied on people not being able to prove their right to exist in the country they had helped build. They were making us ghosts in our own homes. The legacy of the Windrush generation is one of profound cultural transformation, bought at an incredible human cost. We changed the sound of Britain. We changed the food of Britain. We saved the British healthcare system. But the betrayal was not a single event. It was a slow, deliberate dismantling of a promise. We moved from the deck of a ship to the heart of the nation, only to find that the nation was constantly trying to find a way to deport us. The struggle of the Windrush generation is the story of a people who were invited to a funeral and ended up starting a revolution. The ships stopped coming, but the roots were already deep. The houses bought with pardoner money still stood. The carnival grew into the largest street party in Europe. The children of Windrush became the poets, the politicians, and the players of a new Britain. But in the archives of the Home Office, the papers were being filed away. The records of arrival were being destroyed. The trap was laid, and the country was simply waiting for the clock to run out on the people who had saved it.